Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Morning, Aunt Miranda.
Wow, that's like hearing that two of my stuffed animals are having sex.
Five dinners with no dick is, not very gay.
Hi, everyone. This is And Just Like That, The Writer's Room, the official companion podcast of And Just Like That from Max. I'm Michael Patrick King, writer, director, and executive producer of And Just Like That. And sitting around the Writing Room podcast table with me are the people that sat around the Writing Room reality with me, starting with...
Elisa Zaritsky, hello.
Executive producer, writer...
Susan Fales Hill.
Consulting producer, writer...
Julie Rottenberg.
Executive producer, writer, and ta-da-ta-da, director of this very special episode entitled There Goes the Neighborhood. It was written by Julie Rottenberg and Elisa Zaritsky.
They can't see it, but we're waving pom-pom.
About the title and the episode and the fact that Julie directed it. Now, if you haven't seen episode 9, please turn us off and go and watch it and then come back and join our conversation because we have a lot to say. I want to start off by saying writers sometimes move into directing. And it's an exciting thing when it happens. And it happened to Julie on this show. And I love a writer-director because they come from the point of view of the writing first. Julie, how was your experience?
It was phenomenal, mostly because having worked with you as long as I have, I think it's been more than two decades. Having watched you as a writer and a director, I had these two very different pairs of glasses, shall we say. And I remember you on the first day, you were homesick with COVID. The universe just sent us a crazy little surprise twist. Plot twist. And I remember you said to me, you were like, have fun. You're going to be great. Take your writer hat off. And that was really important because, you know, all these years of me sitting in those chairs at Village as a writer, annoying you or whoever the director is.
Village
with all
is
my
not
notes.
A, it's not a destination. It's, it's not some cute town we all lived in. Village refers to Video Village, which is where they put the playback machine and the writers gather around holding the scripts and doing an ongoing caucus about
right.
how it's going.
You're looking at the monitors, you're watching each take, and then
and
after
then
the director yells, cut. So I had to get rid of the writer hat a little.
When I said put your writer hat down, I meant put your script down. Stop looking at the words and start looking at the
yes.
image because you never put your writer head down. And that's the great fun of a writer-director that has worked on the show. I know you know what the target is. So these were a lot of very big targets to hit in this episode. It has a combination of many things. It is a drama. It also has a giant, what we call block comedy scene. That's where a bunch of scenes run together and all the characters come together.
The fundraiser, the meet and greet.
The meet and greet that Harry and Charlotte, primarily Harry, throws for his buddy Herbert. But all these characters dump into this big farce scene. So you have all the energy of the comedy of the farce and plus all the realization of where Carrie and Aiden are and where they're going. So let's start about where they are. And it starts with jump in time. Last we left the characters, Carrie was going to Aiden's farm.
And we wanted to.
In Norfolk,
and
Virginia.
And we know, and we knew right away that it was a great trip from
right,
the end of the episode.
And we wanted to jump ahead a little.
Because we didn't necessarily want to do Carrie Goes to Virginia.
We did consider it.
But the reality is we didn't want to do it artistically. Production-wise, it was hard. It was winter. It was not supposed to be winter in this episode.
And we really just thought the real estate was used. We needed the real estate in New York, I think,
yes,
more than we
didn't
know away.
So we have Aiden returning from his Virginia. And the first thing he says is that was a long week. Carrie's sitting in bed and she's waiting for him reading a book.
And this idea that they have settled into this rhythm of he's down in Virginia with his kids for a week.
Mm-hmm. Every other week.
Every other week.
He comes to town.
Sort of like a custody arrangement. And we wanted to show they've settled into this nice little routine.
They're in the Airbnb.
Yes.
They're sexily domestic.
Aiden has to check in with his kid. So you get that right off the bat, and we get to see Wyatt for the first time, I think.
Yeah, and yes. Wyatt is an interesting character because, as you can see, we're moving this storyline perfectly along for a couple. They're connected. It's working. I mean, what's better than not, like, I'll see you next week. I'll see you the next week. Right. I'll see you the next week.
And every walk, sounds
you
delicious.
Walk in the
marriage
door.
Marriage would work better that way.
And you
sign
feel,
me up.
You feel how much they've missed each other, and they kiss, and she's dressed for him to come in. I know it's cash, but it's,
but it's
sparkly see-through cash. And then we had to think, okay, now what are we going to do? What's the reality? Now that we've painted the fantasy in episode 8, I think, which was like, they're adorable and they're working. And so now what do we do? And you have to start to introduce, what does he come back from Virginia with, but extra legroom smell and also the scent of a family moment?
I just want to remind you guys that we were going to introduce Wyatt and Aiden's other kids via a FaceTime call at the coffee shop with Miranda and Charlotte.
Yeah.
We wanted to lean into
She's
the
gleeful.
Fact that she was excited that the kids were reaching out to her, and that meant
that
she
won
was
them
kind
over.
Of a hit, but yep. maybe not with Wyatt. We always knew
but
that Wyatt
But I also want
wouldn't.
To say that anytime, and this goes back to other episodes, episode 4, about the kids going to camp, I would say we need to see the kids. Julie and Lisa would roar, I don't need to see those kids. Why? Who cares about the kids? And I would go, well, they exist. So, I mean, it's going to become probably important in Aiden's life that Carrie and the kids have a relationship. I don't, what? They're gonna, what was essential and what was important to the Carrie-Aiden storyline is that two of the boys were a fan, and one was not.
Not sold.
And
not
as
sold.
She says, he is not buying what I'm selling. So you can just imagine what Carrie Bradshaw was selling down there as the girlfriend, not the mom.
I also want to say we start the episode with this logistical issue, you could say. They can't stay in this Airbnb anymore in Che's place.
Because they're supposed to be secret.
Right. And of course.
And as Aiden says, I got a nice salute from the doorman, and Carrie goes to, she goes from sex kitten to like Edvard Munch painting, like the scream, you don't talk to people. And he goes, yes. It's my nature.
He's so damn chatty and friendly. He's a friendly guy.
He can't help himself.
So it becomes this logistical issue of where are they going to live.
Because they get an eviction notice that slides under the door. And one of the things we built to was the idea of that pounding on the door. We didn't know who it was going to be, but we knew Aiden was going to be in his underwear. And it was going to be some sort of a dangerous comedy assault.
Right.
From the outside. And then the door slides under and it's his fault. And now they have nowhere to live. And she says, unless we, she doesn't even finish the sentence.
And she looks sort of that cute,
sheepish.
Like, aren't I cute? We
never
could always go
there.
Back. And he says, I'm never going to go there.
So now we have a dilemma. We have a dilemma of Carrie and Aiden have nowhere to live. Che's in Carrie's apartment. Aiden is now going to leave town and go back to Virginia because it's been a week. And the next time we see Carrie, she is coming into Che's apartment, which is really her apartment. And it's not just Che that's waiting for her. It's Che and a kitten. Because a new character has entered besides the kitten, which is Toby, is this character who has entered into Che's workplace and found a box of kittens and opens up the box, and it's adorable and annoying and troublesome. But Toby sort of awakens something in Che, which is flirt.
Yeah.
And well, it's
Toby remembers Che as a fabulous comedian.
Yeah.
Right. Toby sees Che. Che sees Toby. And the other interesting thing in the way it's shot is what's very prominent on Che's laptop is the LGBTQIA flag. And it's like there's a signal between the two of them that they're of a like mind.
They're both non-binary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you see Che suddenly says, I'll get rid of the kittens for you. I mean, I'll take them to the place. And let me know if you're ever doing stand-up. And Che says, yeah, I do stuff. But Che has said, I'm never doing stand-up again.
And also, you get to see Che for a minute just working their job, keeping their head down, doing their thing. And in that moment when Toby says, hey, has anyone ever told you you look a lot like that stand-up? You see the first flicker of like, oh, yeah, like that.
That's
that was
who
me.
I was.
I was
yeah.
famous, or I was that person, and now I'm this person. Yeah. And mm-hmm. then Judy comes over and says, you know what you have to do? Yeah, I have to do stand-up. And, no, you have to get rid of those kittens. You have to find some homes for those kittens. So then Carrie walks in and sees the newest character of the show, the kitten.
And I just want to say, we shoot these things out of order, and the kittens grew so fast that we had to
recast. It was one of the hardest.
The shoot. It was like, the kittens are growing. When are we shooting that scene?
So, when we shot the little kitty first, Julie then had to go back and shoot the scene where the little kitty is introduced. But by the time we got to it, the
little kitty
was 100 years old. I'm bringing it back. The little kitty was a cat.
Not a little kitty.
So then we
anymore.
Couldn't film it until we found, get this, folks, another litter that looked like the kitty that we had.
Which was a very specific color.
It was. I felt like I was a surrogate, and they kept giving updates. They're like, okay, the kittens are doing well. I think we're going to get them down here.
What color are they? Do they match?
Oh, my God.
I don't care if they're young. I want them to match. Anyway, so the idea is that this little plot twist of a new character for Che to sort of be awakened by brings in a new possible character for Carrie, which is this kitten. So Carrie walks in and Che is working on stand-up. And then Carrie says one of my favorite lines. Carrie says, are you doing stand-up? He goes, yeah, but just to impress somebody. And Carrie says, why else would anyone do stand-up?
Yeah.
Was that a reflection on your past?
I mean,
I think it's a reflection on Carrie's point of view about people self-sacrificing themselves on stage for attention, which is not her gig. Yeah. But
it's this scene that Che, when Carrie references, like, yeah, I just came here to change, Aiden's waiting in a bar around the corner, and Che says the thing out loud that I think only Che could, which is, A, what happened in here that was so bad that he won't even come up two flights of stairs? And Carrie uncomfortably says...
She says, a lot of stuff happened in here. She thinks and then just does a blanket generic statement.
And then in response to the question, how's that going to work? Carrie says, I don't know. I mean, that's the real dilemma. It's like the logistical problem of them finding a place is one level, and then it's like the elephant in the room.
And I think even more importantly, why is Carrie holding on to this relic?
Are you really that sure, Carrie?
Yeah, I am. You know, it hit me the other day, like, why am I holding on to it? For what? You know, the man I love won't set foot in there. It's time. You know, and it feels right for me, for us, for all of us.
And Lise, this was I remember you were saying the search for the new apartment, and we can talk about the new apartment. That was one thing. But then why, if this apartment represents such a painful It's such a bruise.
It's a scar for not just him, but for them as a couple, that it was one thing for her to hold on to it and marry big and say, well, I love my old place. I want to keep it. But then the person who literally died in that apartment was Aiden. And so, like, to hold on to it just felt
And yet it was a radical move.
How, Susan?
Because everyone was gasping at the thought of this apartment that has represented so much and that has been her and her independence.
A radical move to get rid of it.
To get rid of it.
Or to even think about getting rid of it.
Think about, exactly.
And remember that this is also, this apartment represents a return, because she tried to live in another apartment in season one of it, just like that, and it was modern and sterile, and she didn't feel it. So she allowed herself to go back to a place that she felt comfortable. And we now have repainted her into a corner of, this place might make her feel comfortable, but it makes the person that she's now with feel uncomfortable. So is it time to sell? And when you talk about selling an apartment on our show, you have to go immediately to Seema, who is the real estate mogul who sells apartments. And that brings us to the beginning of her story, which is, in last episode, she agreed to show Ravi around New York. Ravi's played by Armin Armini, and he's an amazing actor and a really unique character because he represents so many things. He's hot, he's sexy, he's grounded,
international.
He's international, he's an artist, and he's a diva. So you have diva on diva action in an effort to really bring home the fact that Seema is a real estate person, a real estate person living in New York. Every now and then we get to do a special cameo that has something to do with a real person playing themselves. And in this case, we brought in Ryan Serhant, who's an amazing real estate titan in New York City.
It's very rare, and I appreciate, because this was Seema as a professional, how she defers to Ravi, when you can tell she's being driven crazy, but she's still very polite.
What do you think of it?
Yes.
Yeah,
she's pretending to be.
It's like a creme brulee, a creme brulee surfaced with a little tap, tap, tap. And in a minute, she's going to push right through that and get into it. Like, what? And when she says, listen, you cut rate Spielberg, what's wrong with this apartment? Yeah. And he says, is it the best? And she goes, no, I showed you the best five, which is good for us too, because then we don't, as writers and showrunners and directors and producers, have to say, this is the best apartment in New York.
Right.
We say, no, you didn't see that. It was off camera. Mm-hmm. And he says, the only reason, romantically, out of nowhere, we have an Omar Sharif kind of appearance. And he goes, I wouldn't have had these wonderful days with you. And she says, I thought you only directed action pictures. And he says, oh, you want action? Very important that she nod. And then she gets action. And really what it shows is that Seema is now rattled. She's outside her comfort zone. She's, I mean, Seema's even,
all her rules.
She's even walking like not Seema.
It's
she's
true.
Like clumping around and trying to tie her wrap dress on. And I kept saying to wardrobe, has to be a wrap dress so that she can just easily get it on quickly and off quickly. And he's there like king shit in the bed smoking a blue cigarette.
That he actually got under the sheets is, you know, like I'm thinking, let's just think about how that all unfolded.
But she's hectic, which is not a color we've seen on her. Which,
we want frazzled. Yes.
So the idea of real estate and apartments brings a connection when Carrie thinks she and Aiden are meeting just Seema for dinner. And Seema walks in with Ravi Gordy, this international film director. And Aiden knows who he is.
And is a super fan of one of his films.
Which Hulk Pow.
I just want to know how you came up with that title.
Nepal Kapow.
Well, based on reality, it was RRR, which I was completely enthralled by when we were working in the writing room. And I was like, this is what he would do. So Seema is bringing him here for what reason? Why is she bringing Ravi to this meeting?
Because of her friendship with Carrie. Carrie is her sounding board. And is this okay?
She's test driving him.
Yes.
And I think she's really wrestling with, It's fun. It doesn't mean anything, but she's obviously ambivalent about that and wants to, yeah.
I think she's bringing him in to prove that he doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Aiden liking him
didn't help.
And why Carrie's amazed by the fact that these two, you know, come on, what's better than like,
they're very
you
cute.
Bring a date.
And he falls
for a bromance.
Your date likes each other. Like, I mean, it's like, oh, it all works.
Yeah. And it's a nightmare
heaven.
To her.
Yes. And in
it's,
our...
Right. It's nightmare fantasy.
I think she was trying to disprove that he doesn't belong in her life. And the minute he sits down, he belongs in her
it
life.
It didn't work.
And as Asima says to Carrie, who's kind of surprised and charmed and amazed, who is this guy? He's nobody. And then you cut into the bathroom. And they get into it. What's the problem with him? Carrie's sort of just calling bullshit on her whole line of defense. Like,
Asima is the poster girl for the
intimacy issues.
Intimacy issues. But also the Oscar Wilde, the two worst fates in life are not getting what you want and getting what you want. And here's a woman who said she wanted love.
Yeah.
And here's somebody who's a worthy.
And yes, and it helps you see the role she played in that sometimes she can't get out of her own way.
And also, really, the question is, seems to be worthy. Mm-hmm. It's all surface, and she is checking off the reasons it doesn't work. And, of course, the main one is a show business.
Mm-hmm.
He's a movie director. And Asima doesn't have inherent knowledge of movie directors. She just knows that's not good. She's talking about all the DMs, the actresses slipping into his DMs.
And she knows herself well enough to know she's not going to be able to tolerate that, or at least that's what she's told herself.
And this completely independent woman out of nowhere blurts, he's not marriage material.
Which obviously
which is
reveals everything.
Why is the M word even being used?
Who said anything about marriage?
Yeah, and Carrie, and she says, no one. Change the subject. And the subject Carrie takes her to is a new apartment.
And she knows just the place.
She's like, that's her safe space.
It's big. And she said it's too big.
Maybe it's too big.
And then, no pun intended. And Carrie says, well, I'm thinking of, you know, I need a bigger space.
I might need more space.
And then, into the Gramercy Park apartment. We have to talk about the writing room reality of us deciding she might need to move on. And where could she go?
It had to be someplace magical.
It had to be someplace magical. And, you know, when you're writing and living in New York City, writing this show and living in New York City, you're always constantly taking in information. And John Melfi, our executive producer, brilliant executive producer, at one point when we were doing Sex in the City, lived on Gramercy Park in the building next to the building that this apartment actually
is based on.
And I never got it out of my mind. And the thing that I liked about the idea of it is it's, Aiden talks about his farmhouse. It's a red brick thing. This has red bricks, but it also has this intricate craftsmanship, like
wrought iron,
which I think would appeal to Aiden.
It's sort of southern. It looks like southern.
And then you go across the street, and there's basically New York City's Gramercy Farm. It's like look,
it's an Edith Wharton novel. I mean, it is. As preserved as any part of New York. It feels like the Age of Innocence.
Right. And the idea to me that Carrie thinks that this is it, because it seems like it could be good for both of them, and as she alludes to, his kids if they would ever come up. But first we have to see it, and she brings her trust fund, her I trust their opinions, and you see it's a two-floor apartment. And still, I don't care how established you are, when you have a staircase in your apartment, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. You can go up and down in an apartment. It's a very big deal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's all horizontal and 15 rooms, but up and down, come on. So this gorgeous set, and the three best friends walk in.
And the reveal to them of, even if it's not this apartment, I'm selling my old apartment. and that she had to get their
benediction.
Blessing.
Yes. Yeah.
So when we knew that Carrie was potentially going to move, spoiler alert, potentially move into this apartment, we knew it was important. And so did Molly and Danny, the designers. They knew that this was a moment, this light-filled white space. What are they going to put them in? And they picked three classic character, iconic vibes. Carrie's in a flower, a big flower in a painter's smock.
Mm-hmm.
Charlotte's in the most floral,
right.
Big mm-hmm. sleeves, the world according to sleeves.
Yes.
And Miranda's in some version of Sex in the City.
Yeah,
Miranda.
Her power suit.
A power suit, but it's now. Mm-hmm. And it's stylish. And it's not off a rack at...
And it's not boxy.
Lomans.
Yeah.
She's
not Lomans. The, it's a thing.
The
and here
sister.
These three friends are talking about a potential new direction for Carrie. And the shocking thing is the phone rings. And this is a shocking thing. And it's not written, but it's performed. The phone rings. Carrie says, oh, this is Seema. Am I taking the apartment? And Miranda goes, yes. Cynthia decided to go, yes. I think that's Cynthia Nixon, New Yorker, who
yes,
knows about apartments.
Apartment.
I don't so care what right. happens. Yes. And she even jokes, can you see me here? Because I'm moving in with her. But
right.
the reality is, it's not Seema. It's a character we've wanted
met yet.
To meet for quite a while.
Kathy, who
Aiden's
remains off screen
Aiden's
until,
ex-wife.
Until she doesn't.
When a character's off camera, people have sort of invented the character. As
it's
you
like
know, sometimes
Rebecca.
When the characters are on camera, you go away, they invent them or reinvent them. But who is going to be Kathy? And what is Kathy? We knew she was a textile designer. We wanted a kind of a, in my mind, back in the day, the opposite of Carrie, mm-hmm. which implied, I guess the phrase would be, homespun versus city slick.
Mm-hmm.
But because we made her a textile designer who was successful, she had to have her own unique taste. And we were lucky and targeted this actress, which is Rosemary DeWitt. She
has everything.
She has everything. She's intelligent. She's beautiful.
She's soft, but...
But strong.
Strong, I would say. There's a softness about her.
And she's an event.
Mm-hmm.
Because
and
she's
down to earth.
Yeah, and she's such an amazing actor.
And should we say the fun fact, which just purely by coincidence, happens to be married to Ron Livingston in real life, who played Burger on Sex in the City a million years ago.
So that was so that's delicious.
So that's meta.
You
get the
just,
elevator.
Just play with that for a
Push
while.
Meta.
The wife of an ex.
So we have the excitement of seeing Kathy, who's coming to town for
and
the fabric
wants
show.
A meeting with
yes.
Carrie.
And the idea of being asked for coffee with this very loaded, fraught.
Except that we.
She has already said everything was fine with
yes.
Kathy. We didn't want to do that.
Right.
We weren't
meeting for the first
yeah,
time.
We
not
weren't
maleficent.
No. Right.
We wanted to say that's too easy. We had a great time when I was down in Virginia.
Right.
But that would make me even
not
more.
Not a great time. She said it was fine.
It was fine.
It was fine. It was easy. That would make me even more like, then why are we sitting down
right.
for coffee.
I liked it when
right, it was
we
all,
met in a group and it was
right.
fine.
What's happening? And then that scene, I mean, to have those two actors who are both so in control of their own characters, their own feelings about the scene, playing this very polite but
fraught.
Yes. And this stealth.
It's grown up.
And yet you see, I love that there's a moment when Kathy sort of is ramping up to her ask, which is, I know you're a writer, you draw from your personal lives, but I'm going to ask you not to write about my kids. And you see Carrie almost relax, like,
Oh, I can handle that.
Yes. Handle that. Yes, and we have course. To acknowledge Samantha Irby's yes. contribution yes. to that, because as we talked about, what is this scene about and what are they discussing? This came from her real life, which is when she met with the ex of her wife. That
who
was the request.
Asked that she not write about
you're a writer,
the
please
children.
Don't write about the children.
And we loved that, and we thought that was a perfect way to bring their conflict right into the center of the story. And you see Carrie sort of relax, of course, no problem. And then she goes one farther and says, actually, I have been thinking about the children, and I'm planning to move. And you see then it's Kathy's turn to be taken aback. The fact that after Carrie says, you know, I'm going to be buying this place.
This is the moment we wanted to bring up.
And then Kathy says, oh. And then you see her sort of take back the
power.
She says out loud the thing, again, that no one else is saying, which is.
But the audience is thinking. The
yes.
whole, probably from the minute Aiden comes back, is Carrie going to fuck this up again? Is she going to hurt him
again
for the third time?
And again, both women weren't going to lose the very polite, possessed.
They're dignified.
Yes. But she says, oh, I'm well acquainted with our history. And even then, as if that would be the last line, Kathy says, because it's not just him anymore. It's my boys. And that, it's like, how do you come back from that? I mean,
well, that's.
You get a drink, you get an iced tea for yourself.
You get an iced tea, and you have to.
And
that's where we established that no waiter came over, because it was very important that it be mm-hmm. a place where you had to get it yourself. And Carrie says, I can do that. And they don't even service each other. But the thing of why you write a character. A scene is to respond to the history that the audience is thinking about. You cannot hurt him again is so important to the audience mm-hmm. who have been with Carrie for so long.
And so out of line, I'm just going to say, that's pretty fucking
audacious.
You know what I like about it? Go ahead, Susan.
I don't find it out of line. Actually, to me, it speaks to a real mother. It speaks to somebody whose marriage didn't work out, but she still loves this man.
I think that their marriage didn't work out, and they feel like they're friendly because they're raising the kids. She has them 1 week. Mm-hmm. He has them the next week. They live 30 miles apart. He has the farm. She has the city. But the reality is, I think she's worried about Aiden, because guess who had to see the damage? Not the audience. They didn't see it because—
She had to resurrect.
Aiden left the show, he went somewhere. And you better believe that.
She's the one who patched him up.
Patched him up or dealt with it. Not mm-hmm. sure, but mm-hmm. had to feel, oh, this is a Carrie thing. And she also says
right.
in that,
I read
your last book. Now, my question is, did she read any of the others? Or is this the first one she read?
I think it's probably the first one.
But what I love about what we can do is now we've opened the wound. Mm-hmm. Now, on some shows, you never mention it again. But in light of the new Carrie Aiden honesty, in the next scene where she shows Aiden the apartment, she reveals what happened.
And I don't think she would have. I don't think she was planning to until it.
She can't lie to him when he says, are you sure about this?
Yeah,
sure.
Until he doesn't have the exact reaction that she expected him to have.
What's that reaction, Lisa?
I think she expected him to love the apartment just as she did. And then when she says, and another thing, I'm going to sell my old apartment. I think she was expecting him to say, oh, I'm so relieved. I love you so much. Thank you. That makes me so happy. And instead, he's a grown-up and he's reserved. And he says, oh, you don't have to do that for me. That I'm okay for you to have.
She says, I want you to be happy.
I want you to be happy. And
he says, I am happy. But Gramercy Park is a very different neighborhood. And I feel what he's saying subtextually is, three little Virginians, me and you, right. it's a different neighborhood. You have to be sure.
Yeah.
It's not, you have to be sure about me and you.
He doesn't want it on his.
No, you're bringing in the three little Virginians.
This is a really big deal.
I also want to circle back to what happened for me as director / writer that day. The way John Corbett played those first few lines, he was very playful. And then he said, "This is really something." And it's only when she says, "And I'm selling, I just so you know, I'm also selling my old place," that he gets serious and drops it and goes, "Oh, you didn't have to do that for me." And I like that. Like, I hadn't envisioned the
turn.
Yeah.
The bit stop.
Yes. That he sort of dropped the playfulness and it got real very quickly.
I think it's interesting because when I was watching the show, when you handed me the cut, what was surprising to me was that Aiden is so far away from her when he's saying this very intimate stuff. You would think that he would move closer, but instead he stays away and lets the words fill the room. And then he only steps in to make his point. It's like he doesn't run to her to make sure she understands. He's like, "Here's what I'm saying. It's all about space." And one of the things she says about the apartment, "It's big enough for us. You won't hit your head on the ceiling," joke, joke. But there's a lot of space they're giving each other. And that's why the Gramercy apartment is so exciting, because it is more space for Carrie, more space for them. And when they do the, what I feel is almost the vows, when they're standing next to each other under that arch, and then he's saying, "Are we going to hurt each other?" Because she says to him, Kathy said this, and then he goes very human.
Yeah.
And goes, "I'm going to tell her. I never say anything about her."
And that is important. We really wanted to make it clear that Kathy has a boyfriend. It's not like she's pining for Aiden.
Right.
No. No, but he gets to that couple thing. Like, "I don't say anything about her boyfriend." Mm-hmm. And then Carrie just stops that rant.
Yeah.
And says, "We're not doing that. We're doing, what do you think about me hurting you again?"
Yeah. Well, and in a way, I feel like we as writers and viewers, the growth of, like, of course he can't say to her, "You're never going to hurt me. I'm never going to hurt you again." Of course they're going to hurt each other. Like, that to me is real growth. It's like, yeah, we're going to have hard things.
That's what people do.
That's what a real relationship is.
And it's so funny.
And I want to give huge kudos to John, whose idea it was. It wasn't in the script that she pulls him back for the kiss.
After he says,
"I'm going to miss my, I'm going to miss it. I also think if I don't get out of here 5 minutes ago, I'm going to miss my flight." And it was Corbett's idea. And he just pulled me aside and said, "What do you think if, I think right after that, she pulls him back for a kiss?" And I was like, "Let's try it."
And yeah. And then they kissed and kissed and kissed and kissed and kissed. And like, she doesn't want to let go of this moment. And then she goes, "Okay." She grabs her purse and they go out the door, and then Carrie's heading home. And as she's coming up to her brownstone, Lisette, the single girl who lives underneath her.
Her younger
who we've
doppelganger.
Last seen in episode 3, correct? Yeah. And it was
destroyed.
Almost like we needed a sign from the universe. And that's what this gave us.
Yeah, because
for
she has not yet said she's sure, but Aiden, to Seema, Aiden says, "You got to be sure." And she's been holding it. She hasn't taken the apartment yet. We made it very clear. It's still a moment. And then Lisette announces that the gay guys, because I always knew they were gay guys.
Because that apartment.
So pretty.
You wrote that,
because that apartment is too fantastic
to
have been sublet by anybody but two gay guys. They decide they're coming back to claim their apartment, and Lisette is out, and she's rattled. She's emotionally rattled in a way that Seema is sexually rattled. She's pissed that she's going to lose this place. And she says to Carrie, "Can you imagine ever wanting to leave this place?"
And Carrie says,
Actually,
I can.
And as viewers, like as a fan, I can't imagine her leaving that place. Like, it hurt me to
see her walking up that stoop. Yeah.
And it didn't hurt me because I got so creatively excited about Gramercy, but I do understand the emotions of it, having been through many incarnations of boxes coming and going in that apartment. And then when she calls Seema and says, "I'm sure," I feel like we moved forward. And it's both emotional and scary.
I also think it marks another closing of the door on her grief. To be able to let go of that apartment and really step into the future with confidence. It's a beautiful moment of maturation. Mm-hmm.
She's ready to move into a new neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, and the interesting thing about writing a series after so many years is you're always emotionally trying to move people into new neighborhoods. And one of the neighborhoods that we never imagined we'd be joining is Miranda and Charlotte wondering if their children had
are
sex.
Sleeping together. Oh,
I
my
mean,
God.
This is an uncharted turf. But when you guys came up with the idea that there's a dynamic between Charlotte and Miranda sort of wondering if the kids hooked up by the very real problem that Miranda Uber student, Uber driven,
riven,
Uber
ambitious,
career tracked
Miss
is being
Ivy
handed,
League scholar.
Which is that her son that she has funneled hours and hours of homework at night at the table,
right.
forcing this, which is clearly at this point a non-scholastic road. I mean, Miranda is handed Brady saying, "I'm not going to school," in another episode. And she's on a slow burn. And then she asks him for a coffee and then says, "Hey," she's actually been sending him college courses where?
Costa Rica.
Like,
she'll
I'll
take
get
anything.
Him. She'll
yeah,
take anything.
Do,
and she
right.
can work on his surfing?
And get college credit and improve his Spanish. It's perfect.
And Brady...
It's not
clearly, Miranda's son is like, "I smell this, and this is not a casual
back
coffee."
Off.
And
well,
back off.
And as now that I have teenagers, you see that sometimes those of us who might be control freaks, you're determined to do something the way you think it should be done. And I feel like Miranda in that scene is trying in her stealth way to
not so stealth,
right? Not you're right.
the stealth that her, of a Mac
oh,
truck.
She actually it takes a hit and keeps coming.
Yeah.
I mean, he says check out,
yeah.
and it is an important line.
Well, and I love that Miranda. I think she went there on a mission. I think that was like she's not going to give up. He busts her. She comes clean. She's like, "Please, will you do this thing?" He draws the line and is like, "Hell no, you have to stop." And she says, "I will."
No, wait, before
and then
she
will.
Says that,
but
the most important thing in this scene, Julie, is that he says, "You didn't find your direction till you were, what, 56? That's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
That child says to look at
right,
you,
right,
were so sure
you were so
of your
sure
path,
of your path. Mm.
And then boom, you didn't.
And then she calls Charlotte. And
maybe Fabulous Lily will rub off.
So now here's Miranda saying, "Will your child motivate my child?
Go and, all the way to Brooklyn."
And then here's the thing. She walks into the Charlotte York, the York Goldenblatt home post Charlotte working, which is a bit of a chaos. It turns out Harry's not a good, calm force in the house. Rock is now the over ordering, and Lily's controlling Harry's anxiety about who is going to be the kosher caterer that they get for this thing because there was some sort of a...
Because there's one couple
there's
who's
a rumor,
attending
there's
who
a
cares
rumored,
about kosher.
There's a rumored non-kosher dumpling. And Harry's also pissed that Charlotte's been at work till all hours
or
of the night, which is 7:30.
And as working moms, I have come home to... A scenario, let's just say it's hours past when I would have thought that people would have either eaten dinner, taken showers, cleaned up, walked in, and nothing has happened. I'm not saying that I don't have a phenomenal family, but let's just say you feel the guilt and
rage.
Thank you. Rage, that's the word. The quickest thing to go is like, you, well, Michael, you weren't here. Well, Mom, you weren't here. And that's what Harry says out loud.
But what Charlotte actually does for her great friend Miranda, a significant person in her life, she turns to another significant person in her life, Lily, and says, will you go out to Brooklyn to scout? Where? And I want to say that the thing that drops the challenge to Charlotte is when Miranda says, Charlotte, I don't want my oldest son.
My only son.
My only son's my only thing child. To be the, mastering the crinkle cut French fry, because he's working as a kitchen sous chef or
a fry cook
at his dad's place, Scout, which of course Miranda has huge judgments on. So anyway, Lily agrees begrudgingly, and you realize, oh, they're not close.
They're not friends.
They're not friends. Now, they haven't been since they're 12, and she has to put herself in that position. And Miranda is very thankful back in her apartment. Now, here we go. Now and we can jump into Naya.
Meanwhile, she's hoisted herself on her own petard.
Yeah, because Miranda now, remember, when last we left Miranda, she's sleeping in what is ostensibly a padded cell.
Yeah.
She's in Andre's music room. And, you know, when we started this season, one of our goals was to keep following what's Naya's life like post Andre. And what that means is, okay, it starts out small, going out for a glass of red wine and a meal by herself. Mm.
We did really try to chart her path. So she was flirted with by a sound guy, but then we don't think anything happened. On Halloween, around in the Halloween episode,
she got cyber-stalked by a white guy. And then she went into a bar with Terry.
She has her first one-night stand. Excited. But then we worked really hard to figure out, like, well, what we wanted, we knew we wanted her to have sex, enough sex that it would be annoying to her roommate, Miranda.
And also to send her to an amusement park.
Yes.
As occasionally characters get to do in this multiverse.
Sex in the City universe.
Yes. And we also wanted to earn Miranda having to go back to her house.
And I remember back in the Zoom room realizing that the complication would be the bathroom. The one bathroom in the apartment is in Naya's bedroom. So here's the episode where we get to see the complication in action. Naya is enjoying the modern convenience of ordering sex.
The way you order takeout.
The way you order takeout. Which, by the way, when we were writing Sex and the City, women couldn't really do that because there was no internet.
Also, speaking of where writing impacts directing, I personally, from Sex and the City through and Just Like That, have directed numerous comedy sex scenes. And it's really important that we understand that in our world, sex is either romance or comic. We never try to do anything that's pornographic or lascivious, because why?
That's for other shows, or
for porn. Mm-hmm. So here we're handing Julie this giant montage of Naya's having great sex. And Elisa, you were the one who, this is another Elisa thing. I just want a little runner of Naya having sex without attachments. Every now and then there's a really thin slice, I like to call it, story, mm-hmm, that is
that
pertinent.
And we didn't need to get to know this man before he was a whole character.
And the reality is that Julie was handed this montage. And when you're writing a montage, it's like Naya has crazy, fun, tender sex.
Wow. Like with the same guy a few times.
That's it.
But I also want to give a pointy finger to Elisa Zeritsky, because originally you said, like, this could be the moment when Andre Rashad comes back in a painful way. And that suddenly that felt like more of a reason to do this story, because it's all fun and games and she's having great sex and she's so liberated and untethered now in her single life. That's mostly what she's been doing this season. And then to have that gut punch.
And the gut punch is what, Susan?
Well, that she sees on his Instagram page that he's announced that he's going to have a child with Heidi with the hat,
Heidi
hipster
with
Heidi. And we had not paid much attention to the grief she's feeling about the loss of her
By design.
Mm-hmm. By design. It was, no. We absolutely by design.
Yeah, Ben.
But we put it away. But as grief goes, it goes in waves. And suddenly the reality is, wow, I really did. This is really happening.
And the wave of shock and sadness that comes over Naya through Karen Pittman's performance without any words. He says, the guy says to her, maybe tomorrow. She goes, whatever.
Whatever.
And then she just sits back and you see, wow, it's
a flip it's of
like
a switch.
The party
it's incredible.
Is over. Yeah.
And that's the bonus of it. What else this whole tender story got us was Miranda has to pee and they're having sex and she can't interrupt them after having the comedy night of her tossing and turning. Now she's in a robe. I mean, in a bath towel. We've already established, audience, that Miranda lives like, her old apartment is like 3 minutes from Naya. She says, that's why she tells Che, I'm going to go there. It's easy. I can go to both places. So you cut to Miranda coming in up her stairs to go to the bathroom. And the
and
door
who's
bedroom.
There? Lily.
Hi, Aunt Miranda.
In a t-shirt.
Except she doesn't say it like that. She says, like, Aunt Miranda, hi. She's like, guilt. Caught. Maybe. So now we're walking the thin line. The fun of the show is, did they, didn't they? But really the icing on the whole Sunday is Miranda calling Charlotte from the soundproof booth at the Human Rights Watch.
Which is one of my favorite
And watching sets. Charlotte try to justify how it's
possible that they were buddies
or, you know, kids today.
Just talking late into the night. Yeah.
And Miranda says, without her pants on?
When did the pants come off?
You cut to Charlotte, who to me is like a little smug that she's actually gotten her daughter. She followed the assignment. She got her kid to go.
She said, yes, I knew they were sleeping over. Because Lily told her, I'm sleeping over.
Yeah.
And then she wrote the rest of the story, which, like, they talked late.
They're like cousins.
And then Miranda said, no pants on.
And that means emergency lunch meeting.
Just to see Charlotte and Miranda in Midtown, the hellish rush of lunch where everyone's running out to get their food and get back to their desks because nobody takes a real lunch in New York.
Not
all crazy workaholics.
Is the lunch moving too fast? The world is moving too fast for Charlotte because Miranda, DA, lawyer Miranda, is making the case. Here's the evidence. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. And Charlotte's desperate.
Running out of excuses.
And then she says the classic, Brady's not even her type. And Miranda goes,
What does that mean?
Oh, my God.
And that is the fun of the whole thing. And then the way
God
Cynthia
bless
says.
Those two actresses.
The third rail of like mom to mom friends when you fear you've accidentally
and then you make it
yourself
worse by explaining
it. Keep digging. Like, you know I love Brady. And it's like, okay.
She says it just like that. Okay. And then she says, I wanted them to rub off on her. I wanted to rub off on him. And then Charlotte says to the guy, and it's one of Kristen's great line deliveries, I have no appetite. This whole thing is coming to a head at this meet and greet where Harry has decided, because Herbert's running for comptroller of New York City, and Harry believes, as we believe, writers, that Herbert would be a wonderful addition to any politics of the city. He's decided he wants to introduce Herbert to his crowd of lawyers and get this whole thing, get them on board. And the party serves as this great, as
another
I said,
one
buffet,
of our,
feast of bringing everybody together.
It's another assembly ball scene, which all the stories converge.
Yeah, and it starts with Harry and Herbert talking to another couple, and she wants to know where his wife is. And what she's also been alluding earlier in the very first scene of Herbert and LTW is you discover him coming home from work and LTW is asleep at the desk and she wakes up and tries to cover the fact that she fell asleep as anyone
Busted.
Who would. I would if I was asleep in the middle of the afternoon and my type A, slightly judgmental working husband came home and said, were you asleep? He says to her, well, kids haven't eaten. But she says, the reason I'm asleep, and she believes it, is that she's up all night working on his campaign.
Yep.
And it's, you understand that not only does she have a new thing that the PBS wants to, are interested in making her documentary into 10 parts.
And she's doing the proposal for
it. She's also supposed to have made dinner. She's also supposed to have been his campaign manager. And it's like, she's like had it.
Yeah, she's up to here.
You can't burn the candle at both ends like we used to. We're old now.
Not so much old as exhausted from staying up till 2, working on a certain candidate's guest list for the event at the Golden Blatt.
Oh, well, that would be me, and I thank you. Did you finalize it with the campaign office?
No, I didn't. I was trying to get my work done first. Is that allowed?
So we're back to the meet and greet, and the first thing they say is, where's your wonderful wife that Charlotte told me so much about? And he says she's late. So LTW shows up late and says, where is he? And I'm sorry, I'm late. And Harry's introducing Herbert. And in the corner, before they come on, the backstage of this meet and greet, you see that Herbert's a little mad and accuses her of being passive aggressive.
And not having wanted him to run to begin with. And basically
And we knew the reason she was late.
And you're on time to your PBS thing, but
you're
late
sleeping
for
mine. And the reason it's sleeping is that's the pregnancy trait we wanted to explore.
Yes, we didn't want to do the vomit.
Seriously, whenever I see a woman throws up in a TV show and it is, she is definitely pregnant, right? Like, so happily, no vomit in this episode.
Because you can be tired.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. I've never been so tired.
Yes.
As busy.
Something and pregnant. Yes. And so, yes, exactly.
So she reveals to Herbert that she's pregnant.
I believe she would not, had she not been pushed, I think
she would have told him later.
But she blurts
totally
it out.
Picking at her.
Because he goes and goes and goes. And he says it's passive aggressive. And then she says,
I'm not passive aggressive. I'm pregnant just at the moment when he's
being announced.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to hear from our candidate, Herbert.
And God bless Chris Jackson playing
playing
every color of shock, elation, fear,
confusion.
So perfect.
You know, the fact of the matter is, we wanted LTW to have a surprising bump. Around the time when her career is taking off, we wanted to complicate the character. We wanted to play with the idea of this surprise as we are coming into the conclusion of this season. And then, of course, Carrie and Charlotte are in the hall. And I love when everybody's at Charlotte's. It's just a really familiar yet kind of like, she's just like socializing. And she has a little cocktail. And she says, have you met Anthony's poet? So now we know they've been a kiss. And the poet and Anthony are somehow in this party scene, which is filmed with lawyers and a person playing. It's a very 1930s, very Preston Sturges kind of a vibe, Julie. And because you're a writer, you knew that it had to be funny. And as a director, you knew it had to move. So it's a lot. And I love scenes, they're called block scenes, where everybody's involved and it bounces around like a pinball. There.
And everybody learns about everyone else's emotional through line and storyline, because Carrie learns that Miranda and
are
worried about their children.
And also we realized
we tried to keep you out of it.
I have to give Michael credit for the it's like I just found out my two stuffed animals
were having
sex, which was out of your mouth. And it was my favorite line in the whole episode.
And it's rare on our show that two of our friends keep something from a third.
Yeah.
Like, that would have been a coffee shop table. And so that felt like a first, that Carrie's like, what are you guys talking
about? And she walks away. And she walks away.
She
and
can't
Miranda,
handle it.
Imagine how we feel. No. Anyway, yes. Then she walks away and walks straight into Anthony and so happy to see him. And then, you know, like, at this point, all these characters know each other. So it's like seeing somebody you love at a party. Hi. And then he's like, don't get, I hear your poet's adorable. Mm-hmm. Don't get attached. I'm ending it. Green card.
Green card.
Anthony cannot justify why this handsome young man
would want him.
Would want him. And it's just so interesting because Anthony's always been cocksure. Words but, intended.
But he's also still, I feel like that's his protective medal, is like, I'm one step ahead of him. Like,
yeah,
I'm not,
yeah.
I will not be played.
I will not be played. And then Giuseppe comes up with a lovely plate of burrata and very lovely. And Anthony just walks away and says, just get me, make me a plate.
Make
doesn't make
plate.
My, make you my wife. And then he chases Anthony down and says in another room separately, why are you running away from me?
Which is, again, saying the thing out loud to Anthony that Anthony would normally have such a protective wall up that no one would dare to actually say that to him.
And
that's,
you know,
why we
brought
love Giuseppe.
Guileless that he does that.
Yes.
We brought Giuseppe in so that Anthony could fall in love.
We
it's
wanted
as simple
a poetic soul.
Yeah.
And we also saw it, you know, that there's a wall up. Mm-hmm. That Anthony put up, that I will not have sex with you except past a kiss. Why mm-hmm. won't you invite me up, right?
Yeah,
he says
he
on their the first
again,
time.
Again, intimacy issues.
Intimacy
I mean,
issues.
Yes,
and
yes,
the
yes.
first time we see them in this episode, they're coming home from a date, and you've established on the street that this is like their fifth date, and when are you going to invite me up? And Anthony makes excuses about the apartment, which is a very yes. New York thing to mm-hmm. do. And it also resurfaces his relationship with Stanford,
mm-hmm. yes.
that they're not yet divorced. Stanford's somewhere in the world.
It's and a then, whole thing.
And the neighbor, the super's looking, you know, and it's just all an excuse. And Giuseppe, of course, calls
She's
it a
right
bullshit
through,
excuse.
Yeah. Yes.
But now we know they haven't had sex. They're not. And Anthony finally says, you want a green card. And he reveals.
Mm-hmm. My mother, that, I don't need a green card.
He has dual citizenship because of his mother's from Buffalo,
yeah.
which we just made us laugh.
Anyway, now to Julie. Talk about your world-famous spy scene in the kitchen.
Thank you. So, like, to me, what is so funny about Miranda and Charlotte on this little...
caper.
This little caper is that their styles are so different, and yet in this... They have to work as a team. They're spying on Brady and Lily in the kitchen and switching places and trying to play it cool. And they're ridiculous. Like the fact that when they're busted or he, I'm going to say Neil, Brady turns around and that they're like children who just got caught.
Well, they are. And it's like, they, you know, look, these actors can do anything. You've seen Cynthia get out of a naked. Now watch what she's doing with that breadstick.
He just brushed her elbow, though I can't tell if it was intentional or not. Okay, switch.
Oh, my God.
Okay, now they're just on their phones. Maybe you're right.
Oh.
Now they're laughing. It's unclear if they're laughing at the same thing. Oh, these breadsticks are so good.
Amazing.
I'm so glad we came and got them.
Those breadsticks are delicious, and I'm so glad I came in here. But now they're in search of where they are. The Brady and Lily have disappeared, and you discover them outside of Lily's and Rock's bedroom. And Miranda is sure they're doing it in that bed. District Attorney Miranda Hobbs is like, it's clear they're nowhere else, but in that bed.
The act is going on.
And Charlotte's like, no, they're probably just listening to music with Rock with their headphones on. They do it all the time. And then Rock walks by, farce, and they have to say, they'll open the door. They knock on the door. They open it. Nothing.
Nothing.
And they close the door and you see...
Giuseppe and Anthony. I mean, it is the most beautiful French farce scene.
And They're, yeah, it's because they've been making out with their pants off.
Down.
And the fun thing about that, that's another wardrobe thing. I said to Molly, Giuseppe has to have a really long shirt tail because he has a really famously long penis.
Yeah.
So it has to be long enough to cover.
Yes.
It's all intricate, folks. You know, and the other thing, the last beat of this entire story, which is important to us, is that Charlotte says, Miranda, I had a lot of sex my mother had no idea about, and I'm fine with it. I don't need to know.
Well, we originally,
we
thought that Lily and Brady would be
a couple.
Like I think originally, it was going to be out in the open that they had slept together. And I think it was only while we got into the deep writing and thinking about it that we realized it's so much funnier
if we don't really know.
You can think they went all the way or they just talked like Charlotte. It's depending on which character you are in your head. But the other thing of the cocktail party that we got to just thin slice follow through is Harry's jealousy.
Of Mark Kasabian.
Oh, yeah. Mark Kasabian, who was played by Victor Garber.
Planted back in episode four.
When they met at
the anniversary dinner. And by the way, when we filmed that episode and saw Charlotte and Mark like sitting next to each other and the sort of the energy that Victor Garber and Kristen kind of played with each other without even realizing it, there did seem to be a potential spark.
Important. And the interesting thing about when we were talking about Mark Kasabian, we wanted to bring somebody in who was legitimately a powerful person, a real thing, if Charlotte was going to invest in working for him. And you said, Elisa, you know, like a Victor Garber would be amazing. And I was like,
we all said, ding, 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 ding,
ding. So we're like, why don't we ask Victor Garber? Sarah Jessica and Victor are very close. They're friends. And he knows some of us. And he's one of the rare New York actors who has never been on Sex and the City. And it was like, oh, this would be interesting. And Victor was like, I would love to do that.
And he has all of the panache and the sophistication.
Charisma, yes.
Exactly. And I love his opening line to Carrie. I used to date a woman in this who lived in this building.
It's his opening line to Charlotte, when he comes in. And you feel that he's this guy who's through three failed marriages. But if Victor's going to be in the show, we were like, okay, well, you know, like, you have to go through Carrie to be in the show. At some point, you just have to, like, you have to must walk through the Carrie moment. So we're like, okay, the disclaimer is he only likes blondes. That's what she knows from the ladies at work.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's talking to Carrie about his ex-wife. And a very important scene for us because we really, in the last episode, when Carrie says, was a big mistake, we wanted to check ourselves here and have that addressed.
Yeah, I think it was really important to both allow Carrie to have a moment where she wonders if her marriage and choosing Big was a big mistake. That's an okay regret to explore and to have. But I think all of us agree in the big picture of her life, no, it wasn't a mistake. And she, by saying to Mark Kasabian, no, he was a wonderful man. We had a wonderful marriage and it ended too soon. It kind of,
it sews up
that open wound that we deliberately opened. But
it's also two things can be true at once.
Yes.
There was an element of it that was a mistake, and in another way, it was the most wonderful experience of her life.
And so, she wouldn't.
We also wanted to do right by Mr. Big from the writing point of view because he's a significant part of her life and always will be. And then she leaves and gets to show Aiden Gramercy Park.
Mm.
And as that happens, you get to see the outside of the building we were talking about, and you get to see their excitement. And just like that, this is the end of episode 9. Thank you, Julia, Lisa, and Susan. We'll be back again next week to unpack episode 10 of the series, The Last Supper, Part 1, The Appetizer. Stream new episodes of In Just Like That Thursdays on Max. Listen to the podcast on Max and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And Just Like That, The Writer's Room, is produced by Neon Hum Media for Max. At Neon Hum, Cher Morris is the executive producer. Joanna Clay is the lead producer. Sammy Allison is our head of production. Zoe Culkin is our associate producer. Sam Baer is our engineer. That's it for the show. Thank you for listening.